to a PERC podcast brought to you by the Property and Environment Research Center in Bozeman, Montana. This episode features Michael Soss-Rolfes, a South African conservation economist, talking about wildlife management and saving African rhinos.
Thanks. Hi, everyone. It's good to be back here, jet lag and all. Okay, so I'm going to talk to you about a Southern African perspective of wildlife management, this top-down, bottom-up. I'm going to give you some sort of really practical examples looking at South Africa's history, what has worked, what hasn't, and tease out some interesting things that I think will relate to the work that you've read. So let's just start you off with a quick map of Southern Africa. This is South Africa, some neighboring countries, Namibia, Botswana, Zimbabwe. This whole area sits on a very high plateau, and what you see here is an escarpment. There's a coastal area down here, and then the whole plateau area is actually quite arid. So the thing about Southern Africa is actually mostly dry land. And if we look at the history of this part of the world, until just a few hundred years ago, the only people living in this area were hunter-gatherers. Nomadic hunter-gatherers, they had a little bit of livestock, but there wasn't a lot going on. There weren't too many people there. It was very much subsistence stuff. And the Bantu people from further north in Africa were slowly moving down this sort of more fertile, wetter area here, doing a bit of crop farming, bringing in cattle, eventually started displacing some of the hunter-gatherers here. But they only got down about this far when the first European settlers started arriving, actually sailing around South Africa to trade with Asia. They stopped off in Cape Town, set up a kind of a halfway house there. And then the Afrikaner settlers arrived there and started infiltrating here and pushing back into this area. So let's just look at how that affected the wildlife. So pre-1600s, we had some hunter-gatherers, some nomadic Bantu farmers, communal lands, and lots of wildlife. Then in the 1800s, we had a large influx of European settlers, and with them they brought guns, new technology. What they found in the hinterland were vast, vast numbers of game, large, big game migrations. And the new settlers also brought with them their own legal system, which was Roman Dutch law. And under Roman Dutch law, wildlife was regarded as res nullius. Anything that's res nullius is essentially unowned property. It can only be owned if it's killed, captured, or domesticated. So what's the incentive? The incentive is go in there and shoot as many of these things before the next person does. So what happened is there was an absolute orgy of hunting in the 1800s. So that by the time we got to the early 1900s, there was almost no big game left in the whole of South Africa. And by 1800, we already had our first extinction. This is an animal called the blue buck. There was another variant of a zebra without stripes called a quagga. Those animals became extinct. But already by into the early 1800s, we had our first private conservation initiative. There were no other laws relating to wildlife at that time. This is an animal called a bontebuck. It was practically extinct. It was just down to a few dozen animals. And there's a very interesting, just a little historical snippet here. In 1837, Mr. Alexander van der Bale of the farm Nachtwacht enclosed 6,000 acres of ground on the western side of the Karstrivier, about 10 kilometers of Bredasdorp town, which is just up from Cape Town. 27 bontebuck were first enclosed. So here we see the first example of a private conservation initiative long before the government did anything in South Africa to save the bontebuck. Now, just to continue with the history, what happened, the Europeans brought with them a conventional European agricultural mentality. So they started taking over all the property in the country and fencing. Fencing was a big part of it. All properties were fenced off. What was left, you had a few small pockets of wildlife, and they typically only survived in the areas where no one wanted to go. Really inaccessible areas, usually infested with malaria, tsetse fly, made them unhospitable, unsuitable to any kind of farming, including cattle farming. So you had little pockets of wildlife here in these lowland areas, but the rest was pretty much wiped out. Then in 1893, the De Beers Mining Company near Kimberley, there was a big diamond rush in Kimberley. They created their own private reserve again, but it was specifically for the purpose of hunting. The first conservation initiatives were really focused on preserving some kind of hunting stock. So there's a tiny little private reserve there in the middle of the country. By 1898, we had the first government game reserve, again set aside for hunting, which was the Sabi Game Reserve over here. And the Sabi Game Reserve later was expanded and became our first national park, Kruger National Park. So South Africa, along with the U.S. with Yellowstone, was one of the first countries in the world to actually proclaim national parks. But notice again how government followed the lead from the private sector. And, of course, the history of national parks is not all squeaky clean. Local people were evicted, they were removed from their lands, relocated, and unfortunately, that's very much the history of South Africa, is people being pushed out and relocated, and you probably know we all ended up with the apartheid system. The state conservation model then followed this whole idea of protected areas, national parks and provincial nature reserves. They were fenced off. The idea is fence people out, and because there was so little game left over to start with, hunting was not part of the equation. Consumptive use of wildlife was not. It was just fence in, protect, and grow numbers again. But in the early 1960s, we see a new development, and that is the development of private game ranching. And why this came about is the introduction of new technology that allowed people to tranquilize animals and transport them to new areas. So the improvement of capture techniques and the introduction of the first population of animals onto private property. So we had parks like Kruger, where you could get into the park. It was a big five area. It had lions and elephants and all the sexy big things that people want to see. On a smaller reserve like ours, we couldn't have those species. They priced their accommodation, they pitched it at a certain level and a certain standard, which was a uniform level and standard. But in the time that I was involved here, we still had the legacy of the apartheid government. The camps were very much set up for a particular, demographic. Were mostly state employees and their friends and family. It was supposedly priced cheaply, but it wasn't that cheap, and it wasn't that easy to get in the park. The park was always full, and particularly during holiday season, unless you knew somebody who knew somebody, you couldn't get into the park. So in actual fact, what they were doing is they were underpricing the accommodation. There was clearly excess demand during the holiday season, but we, as a private operator, couldn't compete with them because they set their prices so low. We couldn't offer what they had to offer. We had to price even below them, so we were really struggling on our tourism operations. And of course, this effect spread around the country. The only guys that benefited from this were some operators who were on the border of Kruger, who also could offer the big five game experience. But what they did is they offered all the things that you couldn't get inside the park: night drives, open vehicle drives. Being in the park was pretty sort of a regimented, militaristic experience. But outside the park, you could get your champagne and your caviar and your open vehicle drive. And so these guys chased the top end of the market, and they did fantastically well. They got all the high-level politicians and movie stars and those types of people staying there. So they did well. But anyone who's running a regular operation had this problem of unfair competition from the state. The other major problem was massive state subsidies to almost all competing forms of agricultural land use. And as I say here, this is for political reasons. And you've got to look at the way South Africa's politics was structured at the time. The Afrikaner government really pandered to its constituency, which is the Afrikaner farmers. And what you found is the way the political units in the country had been split up, a relatively small number of farmers had as much political voting power as, let's say, half of Johannesburg, our biggest city. So what the government did is they kept the farmers really happy. And through all sorts of subsidies, they were pervasive. They'd provide cheap finance to buy land. Once you'd bought your land, the water was free. The fencing. You could get subsidized fencing. You'd go to the local co-op. Just about every type of equipment you would want would be subsidized. There were agricultural control boards for just about every product. They bought the products from the farmers at guaranteed prices. There was drought relief. I mean, you couldn't go wrong farming. It was a dead cert. You were going to make money, and who was paying for it was the South African taxpayer. But what it also meant is that, and because no one really took an interest in game ranching was actually crowded out by inefficient forms of land use. And the legacy of this is that large areas of the country were very poorly managed. Overproduced or underproduced, but the agricultural economy was a disaster. One great thing about the change in government in the early 90s was that the new government took one look at this and they said, right, we're doing away with all of this. And in fact, the South African agricultural economy has taken a turn for the better since then. Quick broad stroke point. Indigenous wildlife management is the most economically superior form of land use in most African dry savanna ecosystems, which means most of South Africa. That's the conclusion I came to. Now I'm going to just look quickly at a case study. And this is a southern white rhino. Was practically extinct again by 1900. This is the other species, the black rhino. Going back to our early history, when the settlers arrived here, there were black rhinos here on the Cape Flats, extending all the way through the country. White rhinos starting up here. By the time we got to 1900, the rhinos had all been shot out. There was one tiny little pocket of white rhinos here in northern Natal, maybe a couple dozen. So the white rhino was practically extinct. That one property where those animals survived fell under the jurisdiction of the Natal Parks Board. They just left that population of rhinos alone until we got to the early 60s when we developed translocation technology, and the Natal Parks Board initiated a project called Operation Rhino, where they went into that particular reserve, the Shishlui Umfolozi Park, was now bulging at the seams with rhinos. So they decided to go in, dart some of them, and move them around. First, they translocated some to Kruger National Park, then to a couple of other state parks, and then, interestingly, they decided to start involving private landowners in the late 60s. And what they also did is they allowed a limited amount of, again, white rhino trophy hunting. Now, until 1985, if you were a private owner, the way you got white rhinos was to put yourself on a waiting list. But what happened, and this is what I did my honors dissertation on, way back in the late 80s, people were putting their name on the list, and the government again subsidized the distribution of these rhinos. They made the owners pay a relatively small fee, just enough to cover the transport costs. They gave them the rhino. There was a vibrant trophy hunting market. So what happened in 1980, there was a huge price differential. You could pay $1,000 to get a rhino, and you could have a hunter come onto your property and shoot it the next day for $6,000. So what were people doing is they were buying the rhinos, putting their name on the list. The list was getting longer and longer, and the government was saying, I don't know if we can trust these private sector guys. So what we had was a put-and-take situation. There was no breeding taking place because there was no incentive to breed because rhinos were still subject to Roman Dutch law, which said if you bought a rhino and put it on your property, you could only claim ownership. Even if you released it onto your property, you could only claim ownership once you killed it, captured it, or domesticated it. Now, killing it is clear. Domesticating it is clear. It walks into your kitchen. Capture was a bit of a gray area. But there were two precedents in the case law and a gray area in between. But the larger area was already much smaller than your average game farm. So here you had a problem. If you're a game farm, you buy a rhino, release it onto your property. If it wanders onto your neighbor's property, now it belongs to your neighbor. If a poacher comes onto your property and shoots it, it belongs to the poacher. So you could try and prosecute the poacher for trespassing, but the rhino now belongs to the poacher. So that created a very perverse system. So what the private guys obviously had an incentive to take the rhinos, shoot them as quickly as possible, bank the money, put their name back on the waiting list. Then a very interesting thing happened in the mid-80s. Firstly, there were some other rare and endangered species that people started breeding that were quite valuable on the market. And they started complaining about the res nullius system. So the government investigated a legal intervention and eventually passed the law in 1990, but there was a build-up towards it, the Theft of Game Act, where they said, okay, if you buy a valuable animal and you can mark it or identify it in some way with an ear notch or a tag or a radio collar or whatever, you can claim private ownership. We will recognize private ownership. So that made a huge difference. The other thing was that from 1985 onwards, and again, this was an initiative that the private sector took, someone put rhinos on auction. And the auction price was, surprise, surprise, a lot higher than the price that the Natal Parks Board were releasing. But the Natal Parks Board were actually quite good. They responded to this pretty quickly, and they started auctioning. And then we saw something incredible happen. So here are the prices. As you can see, the Natal Parks Board set price in 1980 was 1,000 rands. In those days, a rand was still worth a dollar. Not anymore. In 1985, they had bumped the price up to about 4,000 rands, but the auction price, that doesn't seem right, actually. That's a mistake. It was about 2,000. I don't know how that crept in. The auction price came in at 5,000. 1986, they decided to bump it up. Auction price came in at 10,000. 1987, by 1988, I think they had stopped. They had a set price. They didn't actually sell any of the set price. They put them all on auction. But look what happened to the average auction price from 5,000 in 1985 to 50,000, practically 50,000 in 1990. The prices just shot up. And here are two more recent prices. You can see values of live white rhinos have just increased ever since. What happened with the change in legislation and the change in prices? Now people are suddenly incentivized to breed, and all the private guys are getting in and breeding. And this is what's happened to white rhino numbers. There you see 1960 before the translocation started, and this is a 2010 figure. By today, it's well over 20,000. And 25% of the rhinos in South Africa are privately owned. So what saved the white rhino? Stronger property rights, opened markets for tourism and trophy hunting, market pricing, and institutional support, which incidentally also extends to the government agencies, because unlike in many other parts of the world, both our national and our provincial agencies are structured as parastatals. And what that means is they're self-funding. They can retain their own income. So whereas in other countries, they're just government departments that get handed out subsidies from government, and whatever money they make has to go to the central treasury coffers. These organizations get to keep their own money, so they're almost like quasi-corporations. They don't face quite the same incentives, but their incentive structure is certainly better than just a regular government department. Okay, just a quick add-on. I hope we're going to have time for all this. A new threat. In the last 2 years, and I don't know if any of you guys have read any of this in the news, there's been an absolute surge in rhino poaching again in South Africa. And as I say, unprecedented, sophisticated poaching drive. Now, just a little bit of history. Rhino poaching swept throughout Africa in the 1960s, 70s, and into the early 80s, driven by the demand for rhino horn in Asia. By the early 1990s, it had stabilized, and poaching stopped for a while, but it's just picked up again in the last 10 years. Now, I've done a lot of work on this whole rhino horn thing. I could do a whole long talk about it. I'm going to brush over it. If you've got questions, you can ask me later. But here's some recent poaching stats from South Africa. You can see in 2007, poaching wasn't really an issue. And what has happened is in the last few years, it has just soared. And why? Because prices for rhino horn on the Asian black market have just soared in the last 2 years, driven by both supply and demand factors. The demand factors being rising Asian incomes and a cultural pride, a belief-based market for traditional Chinese medicine, and the supply factor being inappropriate regulatory response to this. I'm going to talk just a little bit about that. When the poaching problem started, the poaching problem had not started. What had happened was there were two things going on in South Africa. From the early 2000s, we had Vietnamese nationals for the first time posing as trophy hunters. They weren't legitimate trophy hunters. They weren't coming there to get a trophy. They were actually coming there to get the horn. But the only way they could legally get a horn out of the country was to pose as a trophy hunter. So you had all these guys showing up for commercial trophy hunts. They didn't even know how to hold a gun. And it was clear that they just wanted to get the horn out. What you also had is within South Africa, trading in rhino horn was legal. So some guys started going around and collecting horns from that people had collected from dead animals. Or sometimes when they translocated a rhino, they'd nip off the end of the horn just to protect the animal in transit. And so these little horn offcuts were being collected, and they were entering the market. But it wasn't affecting rhino numbers in the country. What was happening is loopholes in the system were being used. Trade internationally was illegal under CITES, which is the UN Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. CITES picked up the fact that some horn was starting to filter over to the east. So they spoke to the South African authorities and they said, you've got to stop this. This is a contravention of CITES. You've got to stop this from happening. So the South African government said, okay, we'll clamp down. We'll regulate this problem away. And this is what they did. They passed a legislation, speaking of top-down, this legislation is called TOPS, Threatened or Protected Species. And what they said is, right, every private owner now, every time you move a rhino, shoot a rhino, dart a rhino, dehorn a rhino, move its horn, store its horn, every time you do any of these things, you need to apply to your provincial authority for a permit. So they just wound these guys up in red tape. What happened? In at least two of our provinces, the provinces are in complete disarray. They do not have the institutional capacity to police this. But these guys had to go and get their permits. Now, in South Africa, which is relatively lawless, if you're in the permitting office and now all of a sudden you're getting information about these valuable resources, you've got something to sell. And this is exactly what the guys are doing. So you'd go in and you'd apply for your permit to dehorn a rhino. You'd go to Sipho in the permit office. He'd get on the phone to his friend Lucky, and the next day you'd have Lucky and his mates visiting you with AK-47s. We've come for the rhino horns. So the private sector had absolutely no incentive to cooperate, and in fact, it drove them underground, and it's actually turned a lot of them away from wanting to continue with rhino breeding. We also imposed a domestic moratorium on horn trade. Okay, no trade was allowed to circulate within the country. There was a restriction on live exports of rhinos and a restriction on pseudo hunts. In other words, if you were a Vietnamese national now, you had to really prove that you were coming to do a legitimate hunt, and they restricted the number of people who were allowed to come in. What happened? That's when the poaching started. Because now all of a sudden there's no incentive to cooperate at all. So let's just go in there and kill the animals. So regulatory failure. Black market prices and poaching levels continue to rise. Private owners are now disinvesting from rhino ownership. Prices are dropping. And this has serious knock-on implications for the entire wildlife industry, including the state parks, who are doing very well from selling their surplus rhinos to the private sector and banking the money. Okay, now here's a question. Is there a market solution to this? As a desperation measure, what a lot of private owners have been doing is dehorning their rhinos. But as I said before, when you dehorn the animal, now you're sitting on a horn that is, and by the way, the prices are absolutely staggering. Rhino horn at the moment retails for about $65,000 US a kilogram in Vietnam. That's about that's more than gold and about as much as cocaine. So it's a hugely lucrative. So one horn, which can get up to 7 kilograms, you do the math. I mean, we're talking serious money here. So these poor private guys are sitting there with these valuable resources. So what they're doing is they're dehorning, and they're storing the horns in banks. But there's this stockpile of horn that's growing, and there are these huge holding costs. And people are starting to say, well, can't we sell this stuff? It's worth a fortune. Imagine what we could do if we could sell this stuff and reinvest the money into conservation. So here's a potential market solution. But the international non-governmental community don't like it at all. And the question is, can we satisfy demand through intensive production? And this was taken on a rhino farm. There are a couple of entrepreneurs who actually started rhino farming, even though technically, legally, they're not allowed to sell the horn. But what they're doing is they're breeding rhinos, and they are dehorning, harvesting, putting the horn away, and hoping for a change. They're taking a punt. They're hoping for a change in legislation. What are the motivations for legal trade? Well, firstly, if you bring the market out into the open, you can monitor what happens when prices change, and you can adapt accordingly. Also, you'll most likely reduce the price, because I've done some analysis of the market, and it seems that the demand for rhino horn is highly inelastic. And obviously, with a limited number of rhinos, you've got an inelastic supply curve as well. So what's that going to do? It's going to send the price skyrocketing. If you increase the supply, there's a very good chance that you'll knock that price down quite significantly, quite quickly. The other reason, and this is a two-pillared thing, because there's always a risk that if you open up a legal market, that the price won't come down, the demand will increase. But if that happens, the other pillar of this whole thing is that you can raise funds for protection. If you've got rhinos and you're selling the horn, if the price goes up, that's fine. You're just going to make more money, which you can reinvest and up your rhino production. In any case, so the whole rationale is that you can compete directly with the illegal market. So now back to the bigger picture. Here's an interesting table on land use figures in South Africa, just going back to what I said earlier. Today, government-protected areas make up 7.5 million hectares, or 6% of the land total. Private wildlife ranches make up 16.8%, so they're much bigger than the state sector. And in 1960, there were no private game ranches in the country at all. Today, there are more than 11,000. Here's another interesting table, and this is a change in animal numbers in the country. From 1964, when you see 12 million head of cattle, 39 million head of sheep, 5.6 million head of goats, and only half a million head of game. 2007, the cattle have dropped to 8 million, sheep have dropped to 28, goats are down half, and game is up to 18 million plus. Now, another interesting thing to do quickly is just compare South Africa with Kenya, which has had a completely different approach to wildlife. So in South Africa, we've seen commercial hunting and markets since the 1960s, and as I said, a dramatic expansion of private protected areas and wildlife. Kenya banned all commercial hunting in 1977, and ever since then has become more and more restrictive. Kenya have also been a major push behind the ivory ban, the rhino horn ban, all these trade bans. They have very limited markets and property rights over wildlife. And since the 1970s, they've lost 60 to 70% of their big game population. Why? Because it's all just quietly being poached, and local people are moving into areas that were wildlife estates and turning to conventional agriculture. They've got absolutely no incentive. They can't benefit from wildlife. All wildlife belongs to the state. There's no private ownership. There's no vested interest for private owners or local people. And the only private owners in Kenya who are actually ranching are extremely wealthy individuals. There's a sort of an enclave called the group ranches, but these are very wealthy international philanthropists who don't care whether they make any money or not. So, conservation. We often hear about market failures in conservation, and what I wanted you to think about today is, well, what about government and what about government failure? What about perverse incentives from subsidies? Two competing forms of land use, and to conservation. And by subsidizing conservation, what we're doing in many cases, we're sending out the wrong signal to the marketplace. We're undervaluing conservation. And then this whole question about missing markets, where there are weak or undefined property rights, where if we just strengthen property rights, we'd actually create the right incentives. So here are some of the marketplace challenges. Demand for conservation tends to be in developed countries. The supply of wildlife tends to be in developing countries, and there are these missing international markets. But how are these markets being tapped into at the moment? By large multinational corporate NGOs who sell a story to the public but are actually not doing much constructive on the ground in terms of institutional reform. What they're doing is they're pushing for things like CITES, the Convention on International Trade, pushing for things like trade bans, trying to remove the market value of wildlife, rather than creating institutions that would add value to wildlife, and particularly add value to the people who actually have to live with wildlife on the ground, private owners and local communities. So the result of what we have is inefficient government solutions, poorly incentivized international NGOs, and as I say here, meetings, meetings, and more meetings. And I did my fair share of meetings in the 90s when I was involved in the international NGO scene. and some high net worth individual private investment. It's really interesting. In South Africa, I don't know what it's like here in the U.S., but in the Cape, for example, we have all these fancy wine farms. How many of these wine farms make a profit? Actually, very, very few, hardly any. And what's happened is also in the wildlife industry, there are a number of, again, high net worth individuals who buy these properties. They create these five-star luxury lodges. And a friend of mine is a consultant in the industry. He says it's not ecotourism, it's egotourism. And again, we have these guys throwing vast sums of money at, but again, not running it efficiently. So in a way, they're also part of the problem. Possible solutions, institutional reform, private property rights, and CBNRM is an acronym that stands for Community-Based Natural Resource Management. A very good example of this before Robert Mugabe went crazy and destroyed Zimbabwe was the Campfire Project in Zimbabwe, which vested ownership rights in local communities right down to the village level. It created a system whereby villagers could sell the rights to, let's say there was a rogue bull, elephant bull in living near the community that would come and destroy their crops or whatever. They could sell the rights to a trophy hunter to come in and shoot that animal, and then the proceeds would be distributed in a very fair way. They'd put a basket of cash in the middle of the village and sit around the basket for 3 days until they reached consensus in the village as to how that basket of cash would be distributed. Since Robert Mugabe's days, unfortunately, he went and he changed everything. He pulled up he removed that devolution of authority, pulled it up to the local district council level, which means now instead of at a village level, it deals with multiple villages over a large area, and you can imagine what happens. Of course, the money starts being channeled to specific interests or interest groups or certain individuals' back pockets. You really need to devolve. Other things we can do, removal of real estate, investment, and trade barriers. Other contractual approaches, there's some other innovative things that are coming up, private-public partnerships, but it's important that the public sector just plays an enabling role rather than a hands-on role. Less regulation, smarter regulation. Again, just think of what happened with the rhino story. And then a new idea that an ex-colleague of mine is working on, a green development initiative, setting up a kind of a certification system whereby you can invest in, an international corporate could invest in the management rights over a particular area, let's say over a 10-year time horizon or something like that, and they would be certified by an NGO, but essentially the local management authority would get on with managing, within a certain framework, managing an area in an environmentally sustainable way. Okay. That's it. Questions?
You focus on big game. How does this apply to the smaller, less flashy species?
Sure, it gets a lot harder. So I wanted to deal with the easy stuff, but also to show you how we're not even doing the easy stuff. And if we started doing the easy stuff, it could also spill over perhaps into the other stuff and perhaps cross-subsidize the other stuff. If you think about where most of the efforts of organizations like WWF are going, they're going into things like rhinos. We could solve that tomorrow. And then they could start investing more money in those other tricky issues.
Why do rhino farmers not automatically dehorn all of their rhinos?
The horn grows back. So, by the way, I didn't mention that. So you have to dehorn periodically, and you can only cut it down to a certain level. Horn is like a fingernail, so you don't want to cut it below the quick. So there is a deterrent effect up to a point, but it's not absolute, and some dehorned rhinos have been shot. A lot of people don't want to dehorn their rhinos because if you dehorn a trophy bull, it can't be hunted anymore, and tourists don't enjoy looking at dehorned rhinos as much as horny rhinos. So, So it's very interesting. You've got a multitude of approaches in South Africa. Some people are out there, right on, let's dehorn them all and let's get into production. And other people saying, no, we don't want to dehorn them. Rhinos need to have their horns. And so there's a whole debate going on within the country.
You mentioned potential benefits for the private sector, such as efficient biomass use. Could you speak to that again?
That was just more a broad comment on the industry as a whole. Like if you're a landowner and you're faced with two choices. The one is just to run cattle. The other one is to run game. Cattle, you're very focused. You can breed a certain number of cows. They're going to eat grass at a certain level, and you're going to make beef, and that's it. Now, if something happens to the beef market, you're in trouble. Whereas if you're doing game, you can market the venison, which is the meat. You can also market products. Let's say you were able to sell rhino horn or other beef, but you can sell hunting trophies, and you can bring on tourists onto your property to look at them. So you've got different options. So if something happens to the tourism market, well, at least you've still got the hunters coming, or you can still sell the meat. So it spreads the risk. It's a more risk-efficient way of managing your property.
What's the rate of growth for rhino horn?
You can get an average yield of a kilogram a year. If you look at the percentage growth rate you can get, manage, if you manipulate the sex ratio a little bit, you can get your rhino population to grow, plus the horn regrowth rate, you can get a compounded annual return of 15%. That's an attractive rate of return. That's assuming prices stay static. Now, if prices are increasing, I mean, this is a potentially very lucrative industry.
Is this type of land use a threat to food security, or would it simply be more efficient to allocate land for this type of use and import food?
As you said, it would be more efficient to do that. And what's very interesting to me is the venison market, which is suppressed. Now, we've been under a lot of pressure to produce beef. The EU offers subsidies. They have very draconian restrictions on importation of venison and other meats. There are all these veterinary regulations and stuff, some of which are a little bit bogus. They're really to protect industry interests. We should actually be producing a lot more venison. And venison is a healthier form of meat as well than grain-fed beef. So I see more of a market swing towards venison production. So, in fact, our food security will improve. You know, there are vast areas of the country that are under corn that are actually really suboptimal, regularly affected by drought, and we often end up importing food. So I think food security would actually improve.
What are the potentials for the collapse of the traditional Chinese medicine market?
Everyone said, traditional Chinese medicine is antiquated, it's a fad, it's going to disappear. You'll see in a generation's time it'll have gone away. Well, actually the reverse has happened. It's quite fascinating. Traditional, I took a break from conservation work for about a 10-year period, and what hooked me back into it again was a visit to China in 2007. This was about the tigers, because the Chinese government wanted to start producing tiger bone medicines from farmed tigers. Very controversial proposal. I went there to have a look, and I was actually dragged there screaming. I didn't really want to get involved with this, but I'm so glad I went, because it was a complete eye-opener to me. And I realized these guys are really serious about traditional medicine. It's very much a part of their culture. Most Chinese hospitals have two divisions. They have a Western division and a traditional division. And they will draw from both modalities. And if you think about it, it's like in this country, there's increasingly, and in South Africa and elsewhere, Westerners are increasingly turning to natural medicines, homeopathy, acupuncture, which is part of traditional Chinese medicine, is moving in a big way. So people are looking into sort of more holistic means.
To find out more about property rights and the environment, visit www.perc.org.